Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We are back this time around to continue our ongoing reread of the Harry Potter series of books. In this, the 13th podcast, we will continue our reading of the fifth book in the series, The Order of the Phoenix, covering chapters 7 through 11. My name is Zach, also known as Alias in the interwebs, and joining me we have...
Hi, I'm Michal, Ink as Rain on those forums, Discord. I keep forgetting. Discord.
That's it.
Greetings, it is I, Patrick the Tall.
Hello, my name's Jock. My poor name is Arnold Swore the Member.
There you go. And?
And Mary. I'm Mary on the forums. And this is the 13th episode. This is a lot. I didn't feel like we're... Yeah, I mean, makes sense. We're at book 5, but yay!
And it will take us 13 more to just finish this book. So... Thank you so much for joining for this, everybody. So just a reminder, as always, this podcast is full of spoilers for everything in the Harry Potter universe, including the Cursed Child and the Fantastic Beasts films. Even though we don't talk about those, I still haven't even seen the last one of those. I don't really want to, of the films. I actually haven't read the Cursed Child either. But Patrick, have you been on one of these before?
I don't think so. Maybe a Pottercast at some point, but... No, not that I remember, actually.
All right, so I'm curious, how did you get into Harry Potter, and kind of what do you think about it in general?
I don't know how young I was. I mean, I think we started actually in high school reading it as like something we had to read around Christmas, the one, the Mirror of the Erised chapter.
Oh, really?
And I thought it was quite good, and I was like, okay, maybe I'll check it out. And then... my mom, for a different reason, bought it for my little sister to read, and I just took it and read it for myself.
Stole it. Yes. Stole it.
So after that, yeah, well, I got pretty much into it, and by the end, I bought my own books in English because the original language is better, always. So, yeah. And then my wife is also a big Harry Potter fan, and we've already read the first three for our kids.
Nice.
Yeah, so we're stopping here because the fourth one is people start dying, so that's not good.
Yeah, want to hold off a little bit.
My daughter's 3 years old, so
yeah. I can't remember how young I was when I read this one. It was before I could read. I know that. I remember distinctly not being able to read when I was listening to it. So pretty young, but I don't think I was 3.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think we'll wait till she's 4 because then she will have had her first knife battle and stuff like that.
You got to time those out.
As per usual here in the north.
Yes.
I knew that's where the Viking reference would come in. Thank you, Patrick, for... rising up to my expectations.
You're welcome. Right. Happy to oblige.
All right, so let's go ahead and jump in here with our first chapter, which is chapter 7, The Ministry of Magic. We left off on a bit of a cliffhanger last time. We were anticipating Harry having to do this hearing to see if he's going to be expelled from Hogwarts and his wand destroyed and all these terrible things. So, of course, at the beginning of this chapter, Harry is stressed out. He is very concerned about what's going to happen. He's so nervous he can't eat breakfast, and this all rings very true to me as a very anxious person, anticipating some kind of event that you have to go through that's scary. So, yeah, any thoughts on this like early part of the chapter before we head to the ministry?
Oh, Molly.
Yeah, we'll get into her a little bit more later, but yeah, you get to see her just trying to be, you know, supportive here, but it's a tough situation overall in the in Grimald place. All right, so we have him going off to the ministry with Arthur Weasley. He's going to be escorting him there, and they're going to be taking the Muggle route, which is all very confusing to Arthur, and they almost get lost. And they go in through a telephone booth, which is cool. I have a quick story about this. So a few years ago, I was doing a random Harry Potter trivia thing somewhere. I can't remember. and I got every question right, but there was this 12-year-old girl who also who got everything right. So we had to do a bonus round. And the question was what the numbers were that Mr. Weasley dialed in the phone booth, which of course type out magic. And I got it wrong because I couldn't remember what numbers went with those letters. I lost to a 12-year-old girl. And I'm still ashamed of it to this day.
To be fair, she is the core demographic. So
it is true.
Yeah. I think it's almost reassuring in a way don't know this book better than
that. Adult me is not more informed about this.
Except the fact that it actually relied on real world skills. So
that's the problem. Is that I actually don't. I'm not conversant in the number of letters of a phone, which is concerning.
I mean,
so it was actually not your knowledge in. She's actually more versed in real world skills as well.
All right, go ahead and make me feel worse about this.
It's not the most useful skill.
Yeah, it's not really used anymore. Yeah, but they actually say the numbers here. If you were like a real pro, you would know that. All right, so they go into the ministry. We get to see this cool new location for the first time, which is extremely 9-to-5-ish. It has that very strong vibe of a workplace, which is cool. You get that mundane feeling, but also there's all these extraordinary things happening, of course, because it's a magical place. We get to go down all these different go down the elevator to these different floors and see all these different things they do here, and we get to see how it's just kind of like a day-to-day routine of all this crazy stuff happening with these different aspects of the magical world. So just thoughts on getting to see the ministry for the first time.
I love this stuff. I love the memos. I love the voice announcing things. It's like, I don't know. It always just makes me happy to think about magical bureaucracy, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something appealing about it. How it kind of merges that mundane reality with all this cool magical stuff.
And for some reason, the floors going backwards is hilarious to me.
Yeah, it also confuses the heck out of me every time.
Yeah. So you work up on 2, huh?
Yeah. What is going on here? It makes sense, though, because it's underground. So it kind of, in a weird way, makes sense.
Yeah. For every, like, 5 seconds, like, I can almost grasp it, and then it, like, flips away.
Yeah. It's kind of like I'm going to be really nerdy here. In the Warhammer 40K, there are some of these hive cities that are made, like, built into the ground and on these giant, inhospitable planets. They also do the same thing. I have several different fantasy/sci-fi references that sort of does the same thing, so I don't think necessarily I thought that much about it at the time or now, really. But yeah,
highly conversant in upside down cities.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. So yeah, we get them going over to Mr. Weasley's tiny office. We meet his workmate, whose name I am blanking on. Someone fill me in. Perkins. He's the other guy in the misuse of misuse of
muggle artifacts.
That's it. And
I think we have to give a shout out though to the the Muggle Worthy Excuse Commission. That is.
Oh yes, of course.
They're also.
Yeah, there's all kinds of departments.
Yeah, and Perkins is the one who lent the tents to the Weasleys.
That's right. Yeah, he helped out there. That was cool. And we learned that there is a situation there with a toilet that is being enchanted to constantly overflow. And we learned this is because of wizards who prank muggles, which is a very awful thing, which shows some of these elements of sort of the bigotry against muggles, of just like common everyday things that people are doing. And we find out at the end of the chapter that from Perkins that the hearing has been changed. So very luckily they're actually came here early enough that despite this probably bad faith change of time by the minister here, they're going to be able to rush down to the hearing. So that's the end of this one. Any other thoughts on this? It's pretty straightforward. It's mostly just getting to see the ministry, but any other things on this one?
To me, seeing the ministry, just like it's a strong foreshadowing for the end of this book. And It doesn't, I mean, especially since Harry is all stressed out about this, it doesn't feel as nicely magical as it could be to discover this place. It does feel a bit awkward and stressful, and you get already a lot of the places and what's Harry is going to see at the end of the book and what he's going to look for.
Yes, and of course we're about to head down to I can't remember the name of the level where the undesirables are. Department of Mysteries. I got it. I don't know why I'm blanking so hard today.
You say you won Harry Potter trivia.
I actually am way less good than I was, but that was my prime against that 12-year-old. Mm. That was my apex of Harry Potter knowledge. I'm not quite there anymore.
So while I have you guys, have you thought about the Department of Magical Games and Sports? How important it is for the Parliament or the governmental system to have a specific department for sports.
Is that a thing anywhere? I actually don't know. Is that a normal
thing? Yeah, it's a thing in France.
For France maybe, for Denmark
normal and countries.
Other countries, haven't ever heard of specifically sports ministry.
Just well, Vikings don't have rules in their games. We know.
Oh, we do. We do. Several rules.
We don't have a regulatory body for sports in America, I don't think.
We should, though.
Maybe.
That could actually be a thing. Yeah, but I was just thinking there's a few different weird departments. Also, what is the official Globstones Club?
Isn't that a Hogwarts thing?
A Gobstones Club.
I think it is a club at Hogwarts, but it's also apparently grown-ups play it. I don't think it's a very cool game.
But it's apparently it's not, you know, as you see, it's the 7-6 level 7. You have Department of Magical Games and Sports, incorporating the British and Irish Quidditch League headquarters, official Gobstones Club, and Ludicrous Patents Office. So
okay, that's crazy. There's a department for that. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just thinking that some of these are quite interesting. They have these specifically by name mentioned as a part of the governmental system.
That is somewhat insane. There's a ludicrous patents thing. I'm curious what that entails. I'd like to learn more.
Well, maybe in a future book.
Maybe.
Okay. Please no. But yeah, I think
we're okay.
Yeah. It's more of a.
We don't
like, know. It's like she's specifically going for funny and silly.
Yeah. It is.
Departments just to like give you more of that impression of this weird, almost normal place of work where it's actually totally different because they deal with stupid stuff from the magic world.
Well, that's the thing. It's like we deal with stupid stuff too. It just has different names.
It's totally like a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of humor, where this would be normal for aliens to talk about. It's the same way as we find other things normal. Also, Obliviator Headquarters and Muggleworthy Excuse Committee. So you have a committee for Muggleworthy excuses.
What does that mean?
It's of course when they obliviate people and then give them some excuse. Well, there was a gas explosion. So they have a committee to decide.
I mean, that's actually important, right?
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting that they named it specifically.
Oh, that's where the creative writers of the Wizarding World go.
These people just spend their days inventing stories to explain weird stuff to Muggles. That's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. I bet they're like their walls are covered in like cheap sci-fi and romance novels and like that.
I guess they would also have to have like an outstanding or something in Muggle studies.
Yeah,
makes sense. Yeah.
Well, that was me nerding out.
Okay, oh yeah,
continue.
We learned a lot today.
I just want to give a shout out to Mr. Weasley. He's talking about the ticket taker. He's like, "Simply fabulous," he whispered, indicating the automatic ticket machines. "Wonderfully ingenious. They're out of order," said Harry, pointing at the sign.
We also get, I believe, Kingsley talking about fire legs as opposed to firearms. That's good. All right, Chapter 8, The Hearing. We head down to the Department of Mysteries, and we go into the courtroom where we find that it is an entire array of the Wizengamot coming to judge Harry for his act of using magic in front of a muggle. And we have the interrogators listed out here as Cornelius Oswald Fudge, the minister, Amelia Suzanne Bones. She kind of heads up the justice around here, and Dolores Jane Umbridge. She is undersecretary to the minister. And we have Percy.
Senior undersecretary.
And we have Percy Ignatius. That's not how you say that, but I like saying it like that. Weasley as the court scribe. So the trial begins in earnest, and we have the witness for the defense coming forward, Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore. And he comes to save the day, essentially, and to help get Harry off for this offense. He has Mrs. Fig come forward as a key witness, and she does a bang-up job describing the Dementors. She gets there at the end of the day, describes how horrible they make you feel, and that's enough, I think, for at least some members of the court here. And Harry is cleared of all charges, thankfully, despite Fudge as gaslighter in chief. That's his other job that he has. What other thoughts do we have on this this court scene? Pretty exciting.
And Miss Fig is she's just a gem. The way that Harry described her in the first book, like, "Oh, I don't want to go over there," and her cats and everything. We get a completely different picture of her now, of how she is.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Well, we learn a little bit more. We get, of course, a little bit of her deal at the start of the book. But
I mean, like, in this book in general, the impression of her has changed completely from when Harry just like, "Ah, I don't want to be like put at her place." Whenever Dudley needed to go to the Sioux and stuff.
Like, I think her fear is really telling, because obviously we know in a couple books, like, it will become actively dangerous to be a squib and to be accused of being a muggle-born and all these things. And, like, it's sort of, like, right now there isn't technically any, I guess, danger for her, but I feel like her fear is kind of like a presaging of that.
Yeah, in a way, it's like there's a lot of things in the wizarding world that are not so bad right now, but which they are the roots of why someone like Voldemort can actually have an impact and take power. And it's kind of chilling, actually, to see that that situation. Yeah. Led to something as extreme.
Yeah, it's actually quite. In history, you see that often. And if some like minority or some group, for whatever reason, maybe they did something wrong, gets suppressed, oppressed, they usually end up becoming more galvanized and coming back. Whenever they will come back in history, they will come back even worse than before. So yeah, deep-seated stuff like that would become even worse when Voldemort returns. Spoilers, I'm sorry.
Well, he's back already.
Oh yeah. into the ministry and stuff.
Yeah.
But you even, like, I feel like it's so effective the way you get, the way it's possible. You know, like, we had that scene with Fudge at the end of the last book. But, like, here it's just, I mean, it's a little frustrating because, like, when Fudge is, like, a house elf in a muggle house, and, like, in the moment you're like, but it was Dobby! And then you're like, okay, I see where you're coming from a little bit. In that seems unlikely. But, you know, the degradation of justice, you know, and this is such a small thing, right? Like, just the idea that they're treating an act of underage magic as like a high crime, and that Fudge keeps going like, oh, we don't have time to listen to this witness or that witness or learn this fact or blah blah blah, you know. And it just kind of shows the way that I mean, obviously the corruption that is there, but also the way that these things can become even worse than they are.
Yeah, it's a total kangaroo court. But of course Dumbledore is here, and he, you know, crossed his I's and dotted his T's, as they say. And he was able to have like some kind of response to every attempt they had to kind of block him. Even that Dobby thing, he said, like, I can bring him. I can have him testify if we need to. But yeah, he was able to help out here. But in the end, he leaves without even talking to Harry. So there's that kind of duality of Dumbledore that we're seeing in this book, where he does help out, he does get Harry off for this this thing, but he is not he's not really being too kind to Harry, it seems, and Harry's kind of frustrated by that. So there's that element of this too that we see.
So once again, he throws his weight around a bit little, right? Dumbledore. He again shows how he's more in control of the happenings in ministry than Fudge is, which obviously is going to frustrate Fudge a lot, and already has. Do we think that maybe Dumbledore has too much power in the ministry, being not actually an active employee of the ministry?
Well, I think, as a reader of the books, you tend to, of course, be on Dumbledore's side, so you're always like happy when Dumbledore is able to take control of a situation. But I think, like, actually for me, like, when I'm reading this part, and of course it gets worse as time goes on in this book, like, my feeling is that, like, Dumbledore is losing control of the situation. Like, that feels like what's happening over the course of this book. So you kind of like are like, oh no, Dumbledore is not able to have control of things, the guy who's in charge of stopping Voldemort. So that's kind of how I would respond to it as a reader. But I think if you were objectively looking at it, you'd be like, yeah, maybe this guy has too much influence.
Yeah. Also, the whole fact that you say that this is the guy who's going to have to stop Voldemort. That's the one person that you're putting all this responsibility on. And since Voldemort is the main threat to the wizarding world as it is right now, that would basically put him in control of the whole ministry, right? That is worrisome. And I even though I know that Fudge is not the right person to, like, he just gets annoyed because he loses standing every time he has to go to Dumbledore. That's why Dumbledore at the end loses his loyalty. I think it's still that's a valid point, that you can't just rely on one person, one elderly person that is no longer doing anything to keep him alive longer.
You're gonna throw the ageism in there, Patrick.
No, but how long are you gonna keep him there? How long he's gonna be there? Forever? No, at least not forever.
Well, I mean, no, but I think it all shows how, like, when you dig a little deeper, the whole way the wizarding world works, and who's in power, and who means, and how do you have power in this world, it doesn't necessarily make sense when you just really, look at it.
I don't think there's a government that, like, is good in this. Like, the whole series is deeply skeptical of government, which makes it kind of ironic where Harry and Hermione end up working. But, like, and I feel like Aurors are somewhat exempt from that because there's a certain, like, oh, well, they're the ones who get things done, you know, attitude toward it. Even though in the chapter before, Kingsley is deliberately leading the Ministry in circles about Sirius. But I don't really know what kind of good government looks like in the wizarding world, because they seem to be like professionally incompetent, you know, and they always have been. And it just, it's kind of like in the early books, it's kind of funny, you know, it's like, it's fun that like Fudge shows up and he's just kind of like, oh, this kind uncle figure who's kind of eccentric and useless and goes to Dumbledore for everything. But then like, you know, a real crisis shows up and then, what do you do? You know? So I don't really know what the thesis would be there.
Just on the point about Dumbledore's influence, I think it's worth pointing out, of course, that like Dumbledore doesn't have like actual like hard power. He just has soft power because of his just influence as a person and his fame. Like he actually did have some, but it's starting to be stripped away. Like he was one of the members of this court, but they took it away from him. But yeah, it's the issue is that the actual people who do ostensibly have power are not making decisions in the issue of Voldemort. So it's more of like a clandestine movement, really, what he's doing. It's not really like a decisions being made by like the powers that be necessarily. It's just him basically going rogue and doing his own thing. So I don't know if necessarily like he's being granted too much stuff. It's just that he is a, and I think this is actually pretty true to life. Like he is just a person who is well known and who has a lot of allies and connections. So he's able to leverage that basically.
Yeah, I was about to say that's also how power works in real life, right? It's about the influence that you have. And I mean, we can regret that, but our governments have this kind of external powers that have influences on them. And that's Dumbledore.
I totally agree that it's very applicable to the real world as well. I would just say that isn't that what we try to object towards, that some people who are not like elected or at least employed by the ministry, like the government,
that they have
that much influence. So I'm just saying, yeah. I'm just using the logic that we have for what democracy should look like in the real world onto the Ministry of Magic, and if Dumbledore has had at least so much power that he has, we've seen it also, maybe even though you haven't seen it, Zach, but in the second Fantastic Beasts movie, he also basically does whatever he likes and gets away with it basically. So that's not a kind of power one person should have, and the kind of influence one person should have over any government.
But I mean, yeah, I agree. And I think this book and the next ones, but they also show how actually how Dumbledore isn't that great, awesome, wonderful character that we want him to be. And actually, I don't remember how I felt about him when I first read the books. But when I reread them this time, I was definitely so frustrated with him. Like when you get to the end and you're like, could have said something at the beginning that would have avoided this whole thing. And so it goes with what we're, I mean, it's consistent with the rest of the book, I think.
Yeah.
He's not perfect, and he is... He has a lot of power, even over Harry, and that that has its consequences.
I mean, I think that's very salient to talk about at this point, because we really are entering the phase of the books where Dumbledore's relationship to power becomes critical to everything that's going on. You know, like Dumbledore, the whole reason Dumbledore is treating Harry the way he does is because he thinks that, like, basically his power, his significance to Voldemort is such that he will, you know, that the very sight of him, that meeting his eyes will like cause Harry to, you know, become Voldemort basically, which may or may not be true, but like, you know, and it really only goes from there, right? Like we come to learn eventually that Dumbledore is terrified of having power because of his past and because of his involvement with Grindelwald, and like, you know, and bad things have happened, like very bad, costly things have happened including, you know, Harry being manipulated to the point that he sacrifices himself for the Wizarding World. So, you know, I mean, it's, I don't think it's the easiest to get a grip on, because I think it's very kind of, like, what's going on in the books always, like, as much as I try and pay attention to, like, the top line, to the things that I know are important, I always find myself just concentrating on, like, ah, Dumbledore, why aren't you paying attention to Harry? And, you know, like, I get lost in that stuff. But it really, we really are in the realm now where Dumbledore accruing power and manipulating that power and using that power in certain ways is starting to have, is actually starting to have negative consequences.
Absolutely. All really good points. I think, yeah, it's that dissonant situation where, like, we sort of want him to have that power because we see how incompetent and even obstructive the actual power structures are that exist and the people that run those. But we, at the same time, are seeing, and it gets worse and worse as the books progress, we see how he himself is also hardly, like, in every sense, you know, has the best interests of our characters in mind necessarily, or at least in every possible way. So yeah, it's a very complex situation. And all right, any other thoughts on chapter 8 before we move on?
Oh, should we talk about the Fountain of Magical Brethren for a sec?
I think we see that in the next chapter. Am I crazy?
Well, I'm not. You're not crazy, but you are wrong.
I am wrong. Well, it could be both. Yeah, we can talk about that.
No, I just find it super interesting that it's like, I mean, it's this really obvious kind of example of the way the Wizarding World sees itself, and it's completely opposite to reality, which is something that Harry picks up on almost immediately. And I don't know, I just really kind of enjoy that as a symbol of, like, I don't know, the folly of these people. Because that, I think that there is a way out of, you know, I'm not sure that Rowling ever actually gets there, but, like, I do think that there is, you know, like, less prejudice, you know, elf rights, like, there are ways out of we have to view them as subservient to us, and we're so scared that they are not obviously that we, you know, persecute them and keep them down and have laws against them and stuff like that, you know. That to me feels more remediable than just, like, government's kind of bad.
Yeah, in a weird way, this statue is more insidious than the Magic is Might one, because it's just like, you, it's so much harder to uproot this kind of prejudice.
Yeah, it's less brazen.
Yeah. And it's tied in. I mean, like, all proceeds go of the coins go to St. Mungo's, you know, so it's literally enforcing the idea that something is good and charitable, even though it's toxic.
Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts on 8? Also, we have Adam here. What's up, Adam? He's here. You gotta do chapter 9.
I am here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes. Chapter 9, The Woes of Mrs. Weasley. Dumbledore sweeps out in a dramatic exit, and Harry tells Mr. Weasley that he has been cleared. Mr. Weasley's like, phew, I definitely didn't think you were going to be expelled, but I totally thought you were going to be expelled. Unfortunately, Percy kind of presses right by them and whatever. That's just, Percy is at his worst in this book, I think. Harry and Mr. Weasley run into Lucius Malfoy, who is talking or greasing his way into Cornelius Fudge's pocket. And Malfoy basically taunts Harry, knowing that Harry knows that he was right there in the graveyard and that Harry will not be believed when he says anything like this. Mr. Weasley says that Malfoy is basically just bribing Fudge to listen to him, which is convenient when he's literally a Death Eater. Also telling is the fact that Dumbledore doesn't think that Fudge is under the Imperius Curse because he thinks he's literally just that stupid. Then they go back. Harry donates to the fountain. They go back to Grimald Place. Everyone's very happy and relieved. Well, everyone except Sirius, but that comes up a little bit later. And Harry does have a little bit of maturity in this chapter where he decides not to be like, and Dumbledore didn't even look at me, which is good. That's good, Harry. Harry notices that Sirius is kind of bummed that he is not expelled and he is not going to be staying at Grimald Place, which is a really important thing to note about Sirius's character, and kind of the tragedy of all that. Hermione tells him not to worry. Harry is so excited to go back to Hogwarts, and he's daydreaming about all these wonderful things that will not happen in the next year. And they get their books on the last day of the summer vacation, which actually just like super stressed me out to think of that. Yikes. What about people who don't have access to Diagon Alley right there? Like, what do you do? One of the books is the Is Defensive Magical Theory by Wilbert Slinkhard, which will obviously come up later. And the kids are all like, who's our new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher? And they're like, I guess we'll find out. While they're opening their letters, Ron uncovers a prefect badge in his envelope. Fred and George are appalled to learn this. And Harry is shocked, and Ron gives Hermione the badge, gives Harry the badge to like check it out, and Hermione runs in at that exact moment and is like, oh my god, Harry, I knew you would be prefect. I'm a prefect too. And it is the most awkward. It is so awkward. Then they're all just like, she actually says, oh, are you sure to Ron? It is incredible that these two get married. Mrs. Weasley is thrilled. She's going to go get Ron a broom. Shout out to an excellent line from George, which is, Mrs. Weasley let out a shriek just like Hermione's. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Oh, Ron, how wonderful. A prefect. That's everyone in the family. What are Fred and I? Next door neighbors? Is it George and Nathan? Hermione borrows Hedwig, and Harry is basically just in kind of like a dazed, upset mood, speaking in a very ugly, hearty voice. And then he has actually a good moment where he kind of is like, yes, I have been better at magic, but also it would be shitty of me to take this away from Ron, and I'm not gonna fuck over my best friend by being upset that he got this good thing, which I'm very proud of him. Ron doesn't necessarily turn out to have earned this generosity. However, it is a good moment on Harry's part. They have all their stuff. They're packing. They have a great, big, wonderful dinner downstairs. And Moody is like, hey, Harry. I'm sorry. First, Molly asks Moody to use his magical eye and see what a boggart looks like when it is not confronting anyone, which is supposed to be against the laws of magic, but that's fine. And Molly says that she'll go take care of it later. Moody then basically shows Harry a picture of the original Order of the Phoenix, most of whom are dead, gruesomely. This obviously puts Harry in a very bad mood, understandably. It's quite a dark scene, and he kind of sneaks upstairs, and on his way he passes the drawing room where Mrs. Weasley is battling the boggart who is turning into all of her family, including Harry, dead on the floor. Lupin comes up to help, and Sirius, and he kind of calms Molly down, and it's kind of the reality of what they're doing in the Order of the Phoenix is kind of hammered home just as they're about to leave. And the last paragraph of the chapter is really telling. I think Harry felt older than he had ever felt in his life, and it seemed extraordinary to him that barely an hour ago he had been worried about a joke shop and who had gotten a prefix badge. And I love this chapter. Sorry, that was a long recap, but it's an emotionally laden chapter.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff going on here. You just mentioned, of course, like getting that sense of the real stakes of this situation between seeing that original photo and how many people died in the last war. And then you see here, of course, what Molly is correctly afraid of, of course, as we'll see play out, like half the people in that room with her will die. Yeah. Plus some of her kids, or at least one. So
yeah, and she doesn't even like that. The horrible fandom thing that went around for a while is that like Molly didn't even didn't even imagine that one of the twins would die and the other would survive. Like, yeah. That was beyond her worst imaginings, which is just horrible.
Yeah, it's tough. And that combined with the stuff that you mentioned with Ron being made a prefect, and this really is Harry's taste of kind of being the second banana in a situation. Mm. And I do think he handles it better than I would expect. Because I think, like, he of course is very conflicted about it, but I think he has a legitimate argument about why it doesn't make sense why Ron would be made a prefect.
I mean, I think he handled it better than I would have. And he, it's very relatable as a situation, at least to me, to be just jealous and feel like it's unfair. And but then again, you also know that it's also unfair to be angry at the other guy because it's not his fault. So it's also a good thing for him.
Why not Neville or, like, anyone else?
Like Dean Thomas, maybe? He seems like...
Yeah, Dean Thomas is perfectly right bland prefect material. Like, it feels like, you know, the excuse we get eventually is that Dumbledore's like, well, I didn't want to put too much on you. Like, well, then, like, why make it worse by making his kind of, like, slacker best friend the guy, you know? I don't know.
Because of the plot, Adam.
No, Dumbledore sees something in Ron that other people aren't seeing.
Look, that no one else ever sees.
Well, I do think that he grows with the challenge.
Yeah.
So it might be a good idea.
He has a tough start. It starts kind of rough, you know. He calls the first year's midgets a bit here.
Yeah, maybe. But you see,
But
a lot of Ron's problems is with confidence, right? In general.
Yeah.
A lot of the things he doesn't do well in is because he doesn't have confidence in himself. He is not a bad wizard. He's just not very confident in himself. Maybe a little like Neville. But I don't think Neville would have handled pressure very well until like this year or next year, right?
I don't think Neville hasn't leveled up enough yet to be a prefect, but I do just think that Dean Thomas is right there. He's right there. Being pretty responsible and chill, and you know.
Also,
but obviously for the story, it has to be Ron.
Also, I think Harry has a lot of experience playing second fiddle since he's been, like, most of his life he's been playing second fiddle to Dudley, so.
Yeah, that's true. He's a little more humble than you might expect. And that he could have been if he had been raised in the magical world, he would have been very different.
Oh yeah, he'd been Draco Malfoy for sure.
Yeah. And there's that element too of that you mentioned of Sirius's loneliness here. That thread that is going to be significant, of course. And it does create problems immediately, as we'll see in the next chapter.
Yeah, I find it so depressing, and I don't know. I think Sirius is such a flawed and tragic character, you know, because that is, I find it so, like, so relatable that he would want Harry to get expelled and to stay with him. And also, I have no doubt that Sirius, like, hates himself for hoping that. And, like, I just really find that one of the most human things that comes out in the book.
Yeah.
But that's what happens. That's what happens with the Order of the Phoenix.
Right.
With the people, members of it. They all get broken somehow. Maybe except for Molly and...
Yeah, and we learn in the magical world, like, finishing school, not that important.
No.
Yeah.
Just hang out with Sirius.
Well, no, I mean, it is true that, like, I think part of, and this is pretty dark to think of, but, like, they keep noting that, like, the order is different this time. Like, people aren't allowed in if they're underage, whereas, like, I don't know if they were underage, but they were at least, like, maybe a year out of Hogwarts, maybe, when they were joining the order, you know, and they're better prepared and they're all this stuff. But it does kind of, I don't know, it has this corrosive effect. Like, I kind of headcanon, this is just my own invention, but, like, Moody shows Harry, Gideon, and Fabian Pruitt, who are Molly's brothers. So I kind of think that, like, she saw the photo, and, like, that was sort of, like, before going up to the Boggart, and that was kind of what triggered her breakdown there. But that's just my own thought. But yeah, I mean, it really, and it doesn't end up, like, most of these people die, I guess, at the Battle of Hogwarts. But not, you know, a lot of them get taken out earlier, and it really is pretty bloody.
Not much rising from the fire there.
Yeah. I mean, Molly and Arthur weren't in the order the first time, so, like, they weren't, like, I guess they're well-adjusted adults because they weren't there.
Yeah.
So, kind of, it's not very realistic, and it's a bit of a wishful thinking to expect that just saying, nope, underage are not allowed in the order is going to be enough. Like, I mean, maybe it's obvious to us because, of course, we know, but this situation is clearly evolving quickly, and these children are basically already under attack with everything that has happened at Hogwarts in the past few years. So, like, I get the idea of being of trying to be more responsible than the last time, but I also feel like a lot of the things in this book, a little bit more trust and communication and compromise could have actually just helped, because it's obvious that they are going to be kind of forced to be in dangerous situations anyway. So might as well, plan.
Well, that's why they start the DA, really.
I think it may be just be Molly's fault, not fault, but she's the reason why this rule came into, you know, because.
Yeah, I think so too.
Dumbledore doesn't really care about children, whether or not to put them into harm's way. We know this. For sure, he would use a child if that was the only way to save the Wizarding World.
I mean, I think it's not even about using a child to have just more soldiers in this army.
Yeah.
It's about knowing that they want to be a part of it. They will be, like, they are teenagers. Stuff like what happens at the end are just bound to happen if you don't communicate with them. And I think when you get to, like, these kids being 14, 15, 16, it just doesn't strike me as very smart to completely cut them off happening and expecting them to just sit still and not try to find out more.
I feel like it would be foolish for them to be fully, you know, in whatever the word is, in the order at that age.
But you, like, can have some kind of compromise and just include them more in some conversations.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, like, giving them maybe a plan of things to, well, I guess they don't want the Ministry to think that Dumbledore's having too much power at Hogwarts. So I guess that wouldn't really work. But, like, I mean, I think the problem ends up being that by the time nobody's imagining that by the time these kids are actually of age, all of their mentor figures will either be dead or pretty much out of commission, you know, like Sirius, Dumbledore, Moody, you know, basically Lupin and Mr. Weasley are, like, the only ones who are still alive by book 7 when they are actually old enough to technically be in the order. And I think, you know, I guess you can't blame them for not imagining that contingency, although maybe Dumbledore should have. This book is, like, a lot of, like, I don't really know what the right thing to do is, and yeah.
All right, let's head to chapter 10, Luna Lovegood. So this chapter opens with all the typical kind of getting ready for school craziness. They head off to platform 9 3/4 to get on the train, and Sirius decides to tag along as Padfoot. Probably not a good idea. Ron expresses some concern about being like Percy as he begins to move into his role, as prefect, he heads over to like the prefect area with Hermione, and Harry is left with a new crew of people here. He goes with Ginny to sit with Neville and Luna Lovegood, a misty-eyed Ravenclaw with a magazine full of conspiracies. So that is who we meet here. Thoughts on this one?
Yay, Luna.
Are you a Luna fan, Patrick?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so.
I'm gonna. I know you don't, Michal. I'm gonna lay my cards on the table. I'm a Luna Harry shipper. That is actually my ship. Yeah. So I do like that.
I like Luna, but everything with her makes me a bit uncomfortable because I know that in Harry's spots and in everyone, I would not necessarily be, like, I would be uncomfortable around her, like, not wanting to be, like, I would want to be nice, but I would also feel like she's so weird and and so it wouldn't be not an easy friend to have, I think.
Friends are supposed to be easy, Murray. Come on.
You're right, but I just mean, yeah, she's uncomfortable and awkward, and that's fine, and that's also what makes her interesting and kind of realistic as well, because I was probably kind of an awkward kid at school, except that I was definitely more Hermione than Luna Lovegood, but it's, I get how Harry must be feeling, and it's making me uncomfortable.
They do. I have a friend that out of high school that was sort of like that, and I talked to him about it, what it was, and we kind of sort of agreed that it roots in that he sort of wants to test people out. I think that's very normal when you want them to, you know, talk a bit behind your back and stuff. So you sort of go full max on the weirdness just to test how they react, if they're actually friend material.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think I kind of do that as well. They're all,
you put it on like Front Street.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I think the weirdest thing she does to me is the laughter. Is like when she laughs for like 5 minutes over Ron's very stupid joke. And it's like, I that is like, I think you definitely don't need to be in the magical world to know people who like just don't have that social cue of like, okay, stop laughing now, you know, or, you know, don't overreact. And that I find just so deeply awkward.
Yeah, because you're like, that's me.
Well, I'm always like, that better not be me.
Hey, I don't understand social cues. I get it. I think conspiracies are great. I get it. I remember that, like movie Luna is way better than book Luna as far as like being kind of more normal.
That might be part of it for me, honestly. Still good.
I mean, yeah. I haven't read any of these since I read them the first time, so.
They do add some, I believe they just add some material between Luna and Harry in the movies that I think is good, and that might be why I feel that way. But yeah.
I think so too. It's just like I have friends who just don't feel that way, who are really able to be in a socially awkward situation and don't feel awkward themselves and don't feel uncomfortable, and they're just like, this is not on me. But I hate, like, one of the stressful for me is that I'm always afraid of like weird moments when no one knows what to say. And in real life, it's the same. Whenever I know that I'm going to be with like just a really small group, one person, I'm always afraid of being awkward. And there are some people in my life that I'm with because, yeah, they kind of lack these social cues. I shouldn't feel uncomfortable. Like, that's them and that's fine. But it does make me just very screen.
Yeah, I always was
is that like someone is something along the lines of like the, you know, the, you decide whether or not you're uncomfortable. Like if something's weird, you're like, you can just decide that. And some of that ability, some people don't.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of the same where like I'm very awkward, but I don't really care. Or I just like, whatever.
I've been called intense at times. I enjoy the, and I sort of like relish in the, you can actually be honest and ask honest questions, and that sort of, you know, comes off as quite intense.
But I was so terrified when I knew I was gonna see you just like one-on-one when I went to Copenhagen, because I was so, have nothing to say to each other. It was so stressful. Yeah.
Well, I talk about a lot of things, but that's a different thing. We're talking about Luna right now.
Sort of I don't know, like the classes of coolness, I guess, kind of play out very clearly. Like Neville doesn't want to sit with Luna, and like I like that it's partly because of kind of that breaking of those boundaries.
Yeah, this but is I... a. We do get Cho Chang coming in here, and Harry's very embarrassed.
Covered in stink sap. Yeah. Shout out to Anthony Goldstein, who I think is dropped for the first time.
Wait, what did he do?
Nothing. He's just mentioned. Oh no, he's. I don't remember if he's mentioned in here or the previous chapter, but he is one of the Ravenclaw prefects, and literally everyone in my life went ballistic over the idea there's a Jewish character in Hogwarts.
See what else happens here? We actually get to the school here, and Hagrid is gone, and the concern for our main peeps. They're like, where's Hagrid? What happened? And that will carry into the next chapter. And then we meet these weird bird horse things that are driving
bird,
the carriages forward. And,
yeah, the bird horses.
Thestrals that we meet here. And Harry thinks that everyone should be able to see them, but they can't. And Luna reassures him that he is just as sane as she is, so that is good.
And that's for some reason become like a line that people like quoting, which I just don't get.
I think it might also be a movie thing. The way she says it in the movie is very like mimetic.
Kind of airy, yeah. And I feel like she knows what they are. Couldn't she just like tell him what the deal is?
No.
That would be funny. That would be funny. She's taking the piss out of him.
One thing early in the chapter that I found hugely frustrating was when Moody is like, don't forget, all of you, careful what you put in writing. If in doubt, don't put it in a letter at all. Which is what Harry struggles with later in communicating with Sirius, and what Sirius attempts to remedy by giving him the mirror that Harry doesn't open until after Sirius is dead. And like,
come on, guys. We could have fixed this whole situation.
Yep.
If we'd communicated. All right. Anything else on 10? Nice Luna discussion.
Draco Malfoy's an asshole again.
Ah, yes, that is true.
Oh, yeah. The stubby boardman thing cracks me up.
Oh, yeah. That was funny. All right. Chapter 11, The Sorting Hat's New Song. So this is kind of just start of term stuff. We head into the Great Hall, and Harry is attracting a lot of looks because of the stories about him in the Daily Prophet. Hagrid is indeed missing. He is not there at the staff table. And we meet the new DADA teacher, Umbridge. And the Sorting Hat, as they're doing the sorting, sings a new song. I'm not going to sing it, but it is just
this long.
It is very long. It's the story of the founders of the school, and how they eventually broke up, essentially, Salazar Slytherin left the school. But it is important, the Sorting Hat tells us, to be able to be united in certain times, like right now, which causes a lot of murmuring, because the Sorting Hat usually doesn't give these kinds of comments. It's usually very unbiased.
I hate it when the Sorting Hat gets political.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Sorting Hat should just, you know, stay in its lane. That shouldn't be.
It's entertainment!
Yes, I had that similar reaction to that. I love the part where it says Hufflepuff took the rest. Like, it's just another like Hufflepuff. They take all kinds and Hufflepuff. so that happens. Ron is a dick to Nick here as he stuffs his face with food. And Umbridge gives a speech about how tradition is important and things shouldn't be perfected for their own sake, and the other things should be trimmed and be put into place in the right way, etc. And it's very ominous, as Hermione points out, that this is probably concerning. No one else really notices. I'm not really paying attention, but Hermione's on the ball. And the chapter ends with them all going up to the dormitory, and Seamus is buying into the story about stories about Harry, and that pisses everyone off, and it's all very sad and awkward at the end. So that's what's going on. Where should we start? Do we have any thoughts on the Hagrid thing? I didn't. It's just like a plot point.
I like Grubbly Plank, so.
Yes, we have to mention Luna. Here's a point for Luna. She points out that Hagrid is not a good teacher, and she's right, as Hermione wants to say it, but doesn't. There is that.
He could be a good groundskeeper and not a good teacher. That is, those things can exist great at guy, the same time.
Not a good teacher. So
Umbridge. Also, isn't there like a band in the ministry chapter? There's something about like the chicken being the fire breathing chicken being a clear violation of like the ban on interspecies breeding or something. And I'm like, apparently no laws count at Hogwarts at all, because Hagrid just made the Scroots last year and that was fine, apparently.
Well, we know Hagrid deals on the table, you know.
Yeah. Back he's in the Daily Prophet. How did he not get arrested for this?
Dumbledore.
Scroots.
Yeah, Dumbledore, there you go.
Yep, bring him back to him. He's covering
it. It must be nice to have Dumbledore on your side.
I love it. So yeah, we meet Umbridge kind of properly here. We'll get to know her a little bit later, but yeah, she's the worst.
Huh.
As we'll see. And Seamus, and this is another very frustrating thing, we get Seamus kind of buying into the propaganda, and we see how it's kind of close to home and how things are not going to be so great for Harry at Hogwarts this year. But we do kind of get Ron backing him up, which is nice compared to how he was last book. I always note that Ron is not as bad to Harry this book. He's bad in other ways.
Yeah.
So that's that. It's pretty straightforward again. Any other thoughts on this one?
Well, this is our Lording Hat poem. And, like, it is way too long, in my opinion. But I do love the ending. With, hang on. God, this is long. I don't know, just, like, calling into question the idea of splitting houses. And, you know, that's an idea that comes up a couple of times in the series, but never really gets kind of, I think, played to its full. Especially with the idea that, apparently no Slytherins stay behind the Battle of Hogwarts, which I still have major issues with. But I always appreciated like that very kind of sacred thing in both like the book and in the fandom kind of being called into question.
Hmm. Yeah, if you want to nerd that, I know about a scholar of social science that says that if you go through like sorting and stuff like that, there will happen some sort of negative identity convergence there, where you will end up at the end rationalizing the choice that has either been made for you or you've made yourself, why that's the best choice and every other choice was worse. Other group was the worst because they did this and this, and that by like very automatically you'll start like getting galvanized in the house or the school or whatever you got into, the group, whichever group you got into.
Yeah.
And I mean that it would be, sorry, it wouldn't be so bad if all of the houses were kind of equivalent, and it was more of a like either it's random or it's not completely random, but it's all good traits that are the main traits of a house. But in this instance, you really have this group of people who are considered by the other three houses to be like evil and dark, and that I don't see how that system could have worked.
As a person that's gone to law school, I can tell you that or tried my hand at law school. I can tell you that's exactly how we experienced the first day at university when we had to meet with all the other newcomers. That was specifically everyone who is not in law school jump now thing. So
yeah, I mean, when I arrived in this is such a French thing that I don't have a word for it, but after high school, I went into a very competitive area where you study for 2 years, and then there's a competition to get into the best schools in France, basically. So it's not it's really a competition. You have to be better than the others and to get in the, I don't know, 15, 20, 50 place that the spots that such and such school have. And we were actually like in the first year separated into four classes. And that felt actually a lot like Hogwarts houses. And I think it played into why they did it. But each group, each class has like its own name, and it's all battle shout, which is stupid because we were doing like shouts. It was kind of a competition in the school restaurant at lunch of which class would just shout out the best, which is like really stupid. But it also like created it was random at the beginning, and the names of the classes just didn't really have an impact on how you did after that, because it was just some traditions associated with each class, but it was fine. It created a lot of I think it was actually a good thing. Like, you felt closer to your classmates and you helped each other because you saw the competition as being in the other classes and not in your own, which is not a good thing either. But in this way, you can at least like work together and not everyone just like the rumors that if you were sick, no one would give you his or her notes were totally untrue, because you had this kind of effect. So I think it's not necessarily bad to create this feeling of belonging to a specific group, but I think in the case of Hogwarts, it's just you have these this house that is just evil, and it makes no sense.
I beg to differ. I'm I identify with Slytherin, if I have to say, and I don't think that the ambitious stuff like that. There's no word in the Slytherin as evil.
No, I agree.
It's just that all the characters that are evil are Slytherins.
Yeah, I agree. That's
except for
Zachary Smith is a dickhead.
But I think it's also like a root of what's to come. Like these kids are separated into houses right there and now, and it creates unhealthy competition and just hatred between them. And well, that leads to them as adults actually killing each other. And I'm not saying that Slytherin in itself is bad, but its reputation and who comes from it is clearly an issue.
I think it's tricky, because I do think inevitably there is tribalism in school. Like, I think that's just a part of school, unfortunately. And I think people will be sorted into groups, whether it's an official thing or not. And in a way, I think it is sometimes better if it's like a random process where you just kind of you're not like creating these structures and like creating these distinctive things that are different about you and other people. But I think with this, it's a little bad, because like there's traits associated with each house, and like it kind of reinforces like certain aspects of your identity, and it kind of limits who you can be in a way. Like you feel like you're kind of beholden to be a certain kind of person because of the house you're in. I don't know. That part's kind of bad.
What I mean, if I don't know how it works in the UK, but like I think this is an actual thing. I don't know. I don't think like by personality trait or whatever, but I think that having
in boarding schools
is a thing. I'm more familiar with that in just like a camp situation where like you would just have mm-hmm. different bunks and it would, you know, you would compete with the bunks of your year and then people of other ages. But like that's why I love the DA so much and also why the DA is so flawed, right? Because like I cannot tell you how much joy it gives me when all the characters from different houses are coming together and kind of those boundaries are really dissolving in a tactile way. And at the same time, like, there's no question that Slytherin is not going to be a part of it. And that, like, they have nothing to contribute to this. And that kind of carries all the way through the books. That's actually something I will say for The Fantastic Beasts, the second movie. There's not a ton to say for it. But there is, like, flashbacks to our genuine friendship between Slytherin and a Hufflepuff. That I think is much more. It recognizes the idea that like you don't have to be evil just because you're in Slytherin.
So what if it's only Gryffindor from the because we're looking from the Gryffindor perspective that there's only Gryffindor and Slytherin that really has that thing against each other and Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw is. They don't have the same, relationship.
They're just chilling. They're not getting into all these dynamics.
They might not be attacking each other on the in the hallways like Ron, like Harry and the Malfoy and everything is. What if it's just that? Maybe we just gotten a skewed perspective because we stumbled into the main nemesis of Gryffindor, and.
You do get the sense that Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff are just kind of like, all right,
and we're here too. And we're here. Yeah.
Also because, you know, Ravina Ravenclaw sort of, you know talked to Tom Riddle, like confided in him and stuff like that. So,
Helena.
Ravenclaw, sorry. Yeah.
Trivia master. You should have gone up against that 12-year-old.
So yeah, but she didn't seem to have any problem with him being from Slytherin.
I mean, she comes off as not a very flattering perspective either, I think. I don't know. I think that there is. And look, I don't know how much like this is just me making stuff up about the books. And it's totally fair if that's just what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, like, I guess we are also coming into these books at, like, a politically fraught time. You know, like, they don't necessarily start that way, but, like, they are in the gap between two wars. And, like, within 4 years, like, the Wizarding World is completely, you know, divided and at war. So I guess, like, it's not necessarily that this is. I mean, Lily and Snape were friends for quite a while, you know. So I don't know, but at the same time, like if I had to like list some of my disappointments with Harry Potter and both just in the text and just philosophically, like the fact that we never really incorporate, well, first of all, that we never really get past the house boundaries period. And also that we never really incorporate Slytherin at all. Really bothers me. That was like one of the things when I read the final book and it was like, and no Slytherin stayed, and I was like, I have to rewrite that line in my mind, just like,
you know. It's definitely a missed opportunity for an interesting concept and theme to explore that just doesn't really get
and it's weird because it is introduced, it is actively introduced,
right,
and it's just never played out.
Yeah, I think we talked about this too with the house elf stuff, like these concepts are introduced in the narrative, they're not really followed through always, which is unfortunate. All right, any last thoughts on these chapters before I wrap it up? Okay, thanks everybody, it was great, lots of really good insightful thoughts here. Next time around we'll be doing chapters 12 through 16. That starts with the Dolores Umbridge chapter and ends with the In the Hog's Head chapter, so we're going to be building towards the DA, which is always fun. But yeah, this was fantastic. Thank you all very much for coming on for this. It was a really good time, and thank you everyone for listening. If you want to check out more VOK, you can do so at vokpodcast.com. You can check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on YouTube, all that stuff. And if you want to come hang with us, please do come join our Discord. You can find links for that on our social medias all over the place, and we'd be happy to have you. So yeah, thank you all again very much, and we'll be back again very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.